BBC Sounds app and discover all our latest shows, sessions and mixes.
Six Music.
Right now, it's Matt Everett's The First Time.
I'm Matt Everett and you're listening to a brand new series of The First Time here on BBC Six Music and BBC Sounds. This is the show where we meet some of the most influential and best loved musicians around and take a look at the pivotal first musical moments that made them who they are today. My guest on this episode is, I think it's appropriate to say, a British rock icon. From the mid-90s onwards, the band she fronted stood apart from their contemporaries, especially the Britpop scene, both in terms of musical style, attitude, looks and personality. They blended heavy metal with politics, both gender and sociological, and delivered it in a voice that was impossible to ignore. And they're no more easy to ignore these days. I'm very happy to welcome to The First Time, from Skunk Anansie, Skin.
I wonder what you're doing now. Hope you're feeling happy now. I wonder what you're doing now. I hope you're feeling happy now.
And you just heard one of Skunk Anansie's biggest hits, Hedonism, Just Because It Feels Good, from their 1996 album, Stoosh. In this show, we cover the music that shaped Skin's early life in London, Bluebeat, Scar and Nina Simone. And we hear, actually, an amazing story about hanging out with Nina Simone at Nelson Mandela's 80th birthday concert in 1998. You couldn't make it up. And we trace the history of Skunk Anansie from the bands that inspired them, Rage Against the Machine, Sepultura and Nirvana, to the earliest gigs, the hit albums and the battles and lack of understanding that Skin endured with the media at the time. We also document her own relationship with fame, Skunk Anansie's split and triumphant reunion, and this year's rather fine new album, The Painful Truth. But I started by asking Skin, as I do with all my guests, when was she first aware of music as a child?
I think I probably told this story before, but my granddad had a nightclub in Brixton. It was called the Ephra Residential Club, number 30 Ephra Road. So literally my first memories are sitting at the top, because there was a separate entrance for the club. You know, you could go into the basement, which is where the club was,
right,
from outside. And then there was a door from that basement up to the rest of the house. My first memories are literally sitting at the top step with the door closed and just watching all these people. And we were kind of allowed to hang out when we were little, like 3-4 years old, till about, I don't know, 12. And then we got hushed up to bed. Everybody started doing slow dancing and all that stuff. We were like rushed off upstairs. Okay, go to bed. On a children, I have to go to bed. Because I guess up until that point, they were kind of babysitting us. And then once they started getting a bit naughty, they were like, okay, you can't watch this. This is too adult for you. Forget about half the things that were going on in the records, you know, forget about that. But, you know, I'm too young to watch people crabbing. My dad was in the Air Force. And so we were raised on Air Force bases like Bryce Norton up until about 5 years old. But we'd come down in the summer holidays and stay with my grandpa.
And what kind of music would be emanating from the other side of that door? What kind of stuff would you hear?
You know, I was raised on a nice big fat bed of reggae, and more reggae with a touch of reggae extra on the side, you know. It was like, you know, Jamaicans, it was just Prince Buster, old school, all those old Blue Beat tunes and that stuff. It was all ska in those days.
Madness, madness, they call it madness. Madness. Madness, we call it madness. It's plain to see that is what they mean to me. Madness, madness, I call it madness. Madness, madness, we call it madness.
Your dad was a big reggae fan, wasn't he, right?
My dad is a fan of music, I would say. I got a house in Ibiza and he came to visit me last summer. And all he did was control the music for the whole time. You know, I had this really nice speaker and he was just like, oh, can you hook me up to the speaker? He just controlled the music and jumped rum all day. He had the best time. And I remember that's what my dad was like. There was no silence in my house. It was music playing all the time. And when I was little, it was reggae and then the Beatles.
Your first single, or your first music that you owned, if I'm right, it was Nina Simone, right? Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, because okay. There was this guy, one of my school friends, actually. He obviously got them off the back of a lorry. And they were like these beautiful 10-inch records. And 10-inch was quite rare. I mean, it's still quite rare now, right? You're 7-inch and you're 12-inch, but not, you know, I've only got a couple of 10-inch records in my collection. And he was selling this record and it was I Love You Porgy, Love Me, Leave Me. Of course, My Baby Still Cares For Me and another track. And I didn't get to play it for months and months and months because it was in the front room of my mum's house, the room that none of us kids were allowed to go near. And one time she forgot, she's a nurse, she works nights. And one time she forgot to lock it. And that was the first time I heard this record. And to this day, that's still my favorite record. And I still, of all the music I've ever bought, the memories that come with putting that first record on to still shake me, and I still love all of those songs deeply.
I love you. Let him handle me and drive me mad. If you can keep me, I wanna stay with you forever, and I'll be glad. Yes, I love you, Poggy. Don't let him take. Don't let him handle me with his hot hands. If you can keep me, I want to stay here with you forever. I've got my man.
Is it true you met her?
I did.
What?
I met her. I spent the whole evening with her. This is crazy.
No way.
We performed at Nelson Mandela's 80th birthday party in South Africa because we were, I think, the first normal kind of mixed race, diverse band ever to play South Africa post-apartheid.
Yeah.
And so we got invited down and we had this concert. We had this kind of 1,000-man dinner. And she was there. And I remember thinking, oh my God, it's Nina Simone. At the end of the dinner, we all got to meet Nelson Mandela. He introduced us one by one. And it was quite funny because he was like, Michael Jackson, and Michael Jackson comes up. Danny Glover comes up. You know, it's like Desmond Tutu and Stevie Wonder, which was my other early childhood record that I ever bought, Songs of a Kid's Life. And then we were sniggling, me and Cass were sniggling, like, it's Kankanansi. And then we were laughing. And then it went, it's Kankanansi. We were like, so we went up, and I was standing next to Michael Jackson, and I had Nina Simone in front of me, and Stevie Wonder just there on the other side with his piano. And we all sang Happy Birthday to Nelson Mandela. And then I just kind of like decided that I was her handler for the night. And so I was like, oh, I'll wee you everywhere. I'll look after you. And so we went to the hotel. I'm like, would you like a drink, Nina? And then we just sat there and drank, I don't know, some dark brown drink, which she drank. And just literally just sat there just telling stories and getting drunk and being silly.
Wow.
Only thing I remember that night, apart from she had two obnoxious kind of handlers that kept coming to check if she was all right, but they were so happy that they didn't have to deal with her that night. And, you know, she's legendary for not being in a good mood. She was not easy. I've seen her in concert a couple of times. She's not easy. What happened was that I just took over their job. I was like, you guys, just go and have a drink, go and have fun. And I just looked after her for the whole night. And I remember I told her, like, after about 3 hours that, you know, you're my first record I ever bought. And I told her the story about my mum not letting us in the front room. And she was like, oh, you know, these Jamaican women thinking the Queen's coming around to tea. And that's the only bit I really remember. But she knows, she told me old stories. I wish I could remember more of it. And some of it, even if I remember, I can't tell you. but it was just one of the best nights of my life. Like, my absolute hero, not just in terms of her voice and her incredible piano playing, but just her stories in her songs, how to tell a story, how to transcribe a political meaning in a song. And I think the biggest lesson I learned about it was everything she talked about was stuff that happened to her. And you should always talk about things from a personal perspective, how it happens to you, and not try and sum up the feeling of a generation. You know, we talked a bit about that. But yes, it was just a marvelous, marvelous night. Just the deepest, most heart-melting moments of my life was hanging out with Nina Simone all night.
Tell me about when you first realised that you could sing. I remember, for me, I mean, it used to be, it's not anymore. Seeing Top of the Pops was like, okay, people can invent themselves in creative ways. And, you know, for a lot of us, life was pretty conventional in many ways. And then you'd see Top of the Pops and you'd go, here's people who are becoming something different with music. Did you feel like that?
Yeah, I mean, if you imagine I'm this little black girl in the centre of Brixton, who's part of the bedrock of Brixton, part of the Brixoners that came over in the 50s and 60s, you know, the Windrush generation. So I was the first kind of part of that generation of black kids. My mum was very religious, and it was very much kind of like we keep to our own spaces. And then every Thursday at 7 o'clock, I had this window to all these other things that were going on in the rest of the world.
Yeah.
Because that wasn't my experience. My experience was very closeted, very religious, very kind of like, everybody I knew was black apart from my school friends and a couple of church friends. It was definitely like, we don't mix with them. They don't like us, you know? And then I saw this window of all this kind of music and all these people and all this fashion stuff. It just gave me this real yearning that I have to leave. That was the thing I had to do. I had to leave and go and experience this stuff for myself. I knew I could sing at 6 years old, and I was part of choir at school, and I was ended up kind of running the choir a bit. My whole intention was like, I want my hair cut like that, and I want to wear those trousers, and I want to wear that kind of weird makeup, because that's all I saw. And it was Blondie that hit me the first time I saw them perform. I think it was Denis Denis, and I think she was in a stripy black and white dress, and she didn't really do anything.
Yeah,
you know, she's miming. For some reason, I thought that that was so cool. And I didn't want to be Blondie because I was very much aware of who I was, you know. I was this little black girl in Brixton with hair that wouldn't grow. But I did want to be on that show, and I did want to make music, and I did want to write songs. And then I think of Boy George, you know, when Boy George came along, and that just changed my whole school. The next day, nobody could believe what they saw. There were just these moments in history, you know, like the first time I saw breakdancing was on Top of the Pops. And then the next day, all the boys in school were breakdancing and trying to pop. And then that was it. You know, we were all in breakdancing clubs and breakdancing groups and stuff like that, trying to do us. I can still do some of it.
Can
I
you?
Won't, but I can. I can still pop a little bit. So all of these moments I got from watching this, the first rock tune I actually really knew and loved was, of course, the theme tune to Top of the Pops, Led Zeppelin. Whole Lot of Love. That was my introduction to rock music. I was so closeted and I was so kind of in this small community in Brixton. You know, the way that they thought they would protect us was not letting us outside of it. I just hung out with my cousins and aunties and other people from school, but we were black. And white people were kind of like slightly weird to us because we weren't allowed to hang out with them. And then obviously I had school friends that were white and we just kind of started seeing each other in different ways just because we were hanging out, you know?
What was the first gig you went to that you kind of went, okay, this is an artist, I've chosen this for me, not because it's around or it's a parent show or like a church thing or a school thing, it's just, I'm going to see Cat and I bought tickets for this gig because this artist is about me. Who was that?
Well, that's a weird one because it wasn't really a gig, but as a kid, I was just obsessed with Depeche Mode. That was my introduction to different kinds of music. When I went to college, I became the college DJ because I had the biggest collection of records. And so it was early days of Depeche Mode. And I just loved the sound. I loved the music. You know, I thought Dave Gahan was just sex on legs. And I was a kid and I used to sneak out the house and go to gigs all the time. I wasn't allowed to go to them, but I would just sneak out when my mom went to, she was still a nurse, and I would sneak out and go to gigs. And my friend said, oh, Depeche Mode are playing in Oxford Street. And I've got a ticket because I know the guy who just wants, you know, girls in the audience. I was like, I've got to go, got to go, got to. And we went there and they played like five songs and it was for some kind of TV show. And I'm telling you, there was like 10 of us in the audience. And Depeche were on this slightly raised platform. I wish I could remember the TV show because I've tried to find that bit of footage because I'm sure I'm in it the whole time. And it was just us and Depeche Mode and they were like just singing to us 10 girls because this TV show just wanted like pretty girls at the front. And yeah, that was it. And I think I just stood there with my mouth open and just like looked at them. But I think that's what they wanted. They just wanted like these crazy girls going, oh my God, Depeche Mode is the best thing on earth.
What Depeche Mode song should we play at this point?
I'm going to go to Enjoy the Silence just because it's just my favourite song. I mean, I know they've got lots of tracks, but that was always my favourite and it still remains my favourite.
Words like violence break the silence. Come crashing in into my little world. Painful to me, it's right through me. Don't you understand? Oh, my little girl.
First band you were in. Tell me about your first band.
So the first band I was in was at university, and it was a band called Jess. It was like...
I mean, normally first bands have terrible names. That could be worse.
It was Jazz and Soul Septet, because there were seven of us, and I was a lead singer. And we just used to do really obscure covers. Like the Hue and Cry version of Prince's Kiss and Blind by Talking Heads and just really weird versions. It was just this student union band. I was entertainment officer in my second year and I just put band together. And that was it. We just played for 1 year. And then at the end of it, I nearly got kicked out because I didn't do any work. And at that point, it was like, I got to leave this band and concentrate on my degree. And I guess when I started playing, I started a band called Mama Wild. We used to play in the Water Rats. And Ace, our guitarist in Skaganetsi, was the DJ there. And so I remember the first time I saw Oasis. That was their first London gig and they played there. And Echo Belly and a lot of bands, it was the first time they played their London gigs. I was kind of like already into the kind of black side of rock, you know, a bit of Sabbath, a bit of Living Colour, Mother's Finest, George Clinton, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And that was more the first band, but it was all a bit too bluesy for me. And so when we started Mama Wild, I remember standing next to Ace. And he had this white label and he said, you know, watch this. And he put on this record and it was a bit of a Nirvana moment, but it was Rage Against the Machine, Bullet in the Head or something like that. And everyone just went, we'd never heard anything like it. And I remember on the front of it, he showed me the cover. It was just a white label and it said, all of the sounds that you hear are made by guitar. There are no keyboard or synthesizer sounds on this record. Obviously something that had to stay on the white label. So that was one of the songs that shook me.
Standing in line, I'm pulling the lines. I'm down to the flag. You got a bullet in your head. Standing in line, leaving the lines. You're bowing down to the flag. You got a bullet in your head. A bullet in your head. A bullet in your head.
my dad was into reggae music and really into the Beatles. And so the first kind of rock tracks I heard that I just fell in love with were off that Yellow Submarine record. Because we loved the film. We didn't get the drug references or anything like that. And my dad used to play all the time.
Official Skunk Anansie rehearsal. And when I ask people about their first rehearsals, things either go two ways. People are always like, we knew there was something. We don't know what it was. It wasn't polished, but we just knew this group of individuals, there was something there. Or people say, we were just a complete mess and we don't know how, but eventually we got there and it was like catastrophically bad.
We were the first one.
Hey.
You know, it was me and Cass and Ace, and we had a different drummer. He was the drummer that was in Mama Wild. And within 30 seconds, we just started laughing. We just didn't know what to play. We just kind of started jamming and it just gelled straight away.
Nice.
Instantly. And we just started laughing because we were like, you know, when you'd been in bands for a couple of years, you played with lots of people. It was just there. It was right. It was just perfect. We just knew we had it. We had it from the first 30 seconds. And even with the wrong drummer, but it was just me, Cass and Ace. We just looked at each other. We were like, this is it. This is the band that's going to take us somewhere. After Mama Wild not taken us anywhere, Ace was in bands for a long time. Cass was in bands. I think it was with Terence Trent D'Arby before us. And this was the first time we all just felt, this is our band. This is what we're supposed to be doing.
So when that first single came out, at the time I remember people in the 90s regarding themselves as being kind of pretty, you know, oh, we've put aside the 80s, we've put aside sexism and racism and we're socially minded. And you look back on the 90s and it really wasn't. I just wondered what you remember of your first, your first experiences like with the media off the back of that first single, and kind of how you felt when it, okay, all of a sudden you become a mouthpiece for the band and people want to know about you. It's a different thing.
It was very strange. Journalists literally didn't know what to ask me. They didn't know how to talk to me. They just weren't used to speaking to anybody like me. And so most of the journalists were just, it was just an odd thing because they couldn't flirt with me because I wasn't very flirtatious at all. I wasn't in that vine because, you know, we had a very strict manager and we're like, we're not allowed to flirt with journalists or anything like that. And then also we were just completely different than everything else that was around at the moment. You know, I had to fight to be part of the indie scene and the rock scene, whereas most people had been hearing records from birth that were, you know, ended up being the bands that they were in. You know, I didn't have that kind of history and legacy. I had Beatles and then a bunch of reggae records and then, you know, The Cure. So I'd had to find it and fight for it and just devour everything in a much shorter space of time. And I think they weren't used to speaking to someone who was also kind of queer. I didn't know I was queer at the time. I didn't really get it, you know, but they were asking me about boyfriends and asking me about just very strange things. Until I'd get like a queer guy. This guy called Carl, I forget his second name, but he's worked with NME and he just got us straight away. Really? The weird characters got us straight away. We started off, so the first year was great, and then Britpop came in. Mm-hmm. And then we were kind of almost cast aside. We're like, oh, you're not Britpop. We don't like you. So it got even weirder until we got to Europe. I kind of got used to talking about what I wanted to talk about because the questions were always a bit weird.
Right.
Like, what does your mum think about you playing this kind of music and stuff like that? What does your boyfriend think? You know, does he think it's bad that you're in a rock band or whatever? And I'd be like, well, I don't have a boyfriend. I've got a girlfriend at the moment. But it was more kind of questions were based around what other people thought about me doing it. I mean, I think people thought there was a Svengali behind us that had put us together.
Really?
This is kind of perfect looking. Yeah. Yeah, so it was strange. But, you know, I think the thing that saves me was by the time I got to be in that position, I was 26 years old,
yeah,
looking 18. So I was a grown-ass woman and I'd been through a lot of really horrible stuff, you know, with ex-boyfriends and just kind of being kicked out of the house because I was playing rock music and I was, you know, gay and or bisexual, whatever. And so by that point, I found myself somewhere to live. I was very, you know, strong about what I was doing. You know, we got the band together, spent years being in other bands that didn't work and got Skunk and Nancy together. So I was quite, you know, an opinionated little brat by the time I got to leave Skunk and Nancy. You know, I don't think I was that easy. And I was definitely more aggressive than I probably needed to be at that point in my life. But it worked. You know, I think being a strong character, if I'd been anything else, I just got swallowed up by other people's perspectives of what they thought I should be.
I remember, if you think about Week as being the kind of breakthrough moment, although, you know, just say you've been building up in Europe and like it had been snowballing before that point. You know, some bands, when they have their first breakthrough hit, they're kind of like almost catching their breath and like, oh, wow, look at this, we're on the roller coaster. By the time week comes along, you're like, yeah, we are absolutely ready for this. Our live show is really locked down and we can give the interviews and we can play the bigger places because we play that well. It was professionally executed. You were on a mission by that point. And obviously then you have a song like that that kind of really cuts through. I don't know if the reality was a bit more chaotic than that, but it looked like we've been waiting for this and we are not going to drop this bone from our teeth.
Yeah, we're probably blagging it and bluffing it a bit, to be honest. Because reality, we was very insecure. I felt quite insecure as a singer. But I did a lot of bluffing, did a lot of kind of pretending I was much stronger than I actually was. I don't think that ever goes away, really. I think that most singers kind of fake it a bit and hide their insecurities a bit, because as a lead singer, you're not really allowed to be like that. You know, you've got to be strong for the rest of the band and represent and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But no, by the time that song came along, we'd done 5 tours of the UK. We'd hadn't quite started playing in Europe, but beginning to start to play in Europe. But we were really solid as a rock band. As I said, the chemistry was there. All we had to do was just do a bunch of gigs. And so we were really solid. And we were kind of used to the shock of people first seeing what we looked like, because a lot of people were into us and then we'd do a gig and they were like, you know. I remember the first 3 songs, the first song people were just in shock. The second thing, they were kind of like head tilted. Oh, this isn't bad. And by the 3rd song, when they were moshing around and it was just madness, you know, every good 3 songs. But I was very much aware that we weren't going to be given the same grace as everybody else. And so we had to be good. There was no fluffing around. There was no half-hearted stuff. There was no being tired or whatever. We just had to be like so much better than everybody else. And I think that attitude is a good one. You know, I think that sometimes people forget that it's not supposed to be easy. It's supposed to be hard. And yeah, we had a lot of things against us, but that actually made us better as a band. And I don't want it to have been any other way, you know. I'm really glad that it was tough. You know, that really set us up for a lifetime of being in a band. And I would always turn negatives into a positive and just put it in the music. And that was our thing. Every band was a battle in a big war. You know, the big war at the time was like Britpop. So like, yeah, we have to be better than all these Britpop bands. There was no being average. We just had to blast people away with our goodness.
So, you know, you've got that imperial phase when it's like, it's really blowing up. Were you good at being famous? Were you comfortable being the centre of attention?
It took a long time to get used to it. I mean, the first few years, and still sometimes, had really bad stage fright. So before I walked on stage, I'd literally be shaking like a leaf,
really?
Just literally terrified and saying to myself, why did I do this? Why did I put myself in this position? I was so scared. And then I'd walk on the stage and just blag it for the first 2 songs. And then I'd be all right by the 3rd song.
Seriously?
But yeah, it was terrifying. It was really terrifying. I'm quite shy by nature. So I just revert to being like a scared little Christian black girl that was just scared of everything and, you know, trying to be 100 ways to be a good girl so I didn't get like hit by my mum for being naughty or something. So that's never really left me. But then I'd walk on stage and blag it for the first song and a half, and then I would get into the zone and I'd be okay. But yeah, it takes a lot of getting used to. I mean, the good thing about it was that we do a gig and all that fuss and bother would happen behind us, and there was no social media, there was no internet. We didn't know. So we just saw every gig as our very first gig and, you know, wowing people. Then we'd move on, and all the fuss and all the steam that was gathering was behind us. And we weren't really aware of it until we went to make the 3rd album. It was the first time in our career we actually stopped. And then suddenly I thought, oh my God, I'm quite famous. You know, people are like pointing me in the street because, I mean, there was only one singer that looked like me. And that took a bit of getting used to, because people just do weird things. I don't know if people realize what they look like if David Bowie walked into the room, and people really change, and they change into something that they don't necessarily recognize. And it's not always the best parts of their character. So I just had to get used to dealing with people, and I didn't want to hide, and I didn't want it to destroy me, and I didn't want to become like an ego. You know, there was a moment when my ego went a bit crazy and I thought, oh, that wasn't good. And I got, you know, taken down a few steps by management.
Tell me what happened.
You know, that first album came out and it did really well. And I was just getting all this praise and people bigging me up, and I kind of believed it a bit. And I remember going to meet my manager and an old friend of hers that knew us before we were famous, and I was a bit cocky with them. And, you know, after that, my manager took me aside and she just gave me the right act and just told me about myself. And I went home and I thought she was 100% right. She was 100% right. I'm turning into some of the thoughts I'm having in my own head are just not good. And that really changed my perspective and brought me down to size. And since then, I've always remembered that conversation. You know, it's good to have people around you that, like, oi, listen, you know, you're not all that. In my life, I've had a lot of those people that I've been attracted to that as friends that are, even now, keep me on the level.
It's always fascinating when bands stop, when whatever it is a band does, they decide not to do it for a while. And sometimes it's really mundane, and sometimes it's like the tambourine was too loud on that song and I can no longer work with you anymore. And sometimes it's like, I love you, but I can't do this. Tell me about first thinking, I think we've come as far as we can. Tell me about that moment.
I think at that moment, we were living very separate lives because we were always really good friends and running around the world like a pack of wolves. And then individually, we started to have our own kind of friends and networks of people, and they didn't come together anymore. And I think we all had like that one friend that was all slagging off everybody else, and, you know. But I just remember feeling quite alone, because in the early years, the band used to get quite annoyed because I was getting a lot of attention, and people could be quite rude to other members of the band. Right. You know, I think every band knows that. And I was very much like, well, it's not my fault. I'm just a lead singer and I haven't changed and stuff like that. And then there came this turning point where they realized that, oh, I don't want that attention that she's getting. I don't want to do that. Because they realized that how much less fun that I have than they do. You know, they can go anywhere they want and do anything they want. And, you know, I think Cass, for instance, is much better suited towards being a famous person or well-known person than me.
Right.
I didn't really like it, to be honest. And we got to a size that we were like really big, and my life was just full of annoyances. And they stopped wanting to be around me, because then they either had to be part of it or protect me from it in many ways. Especially Cassie, who's not my big brother. And so I was just always on my own. They would go out to dinner and then I would be on my own because nobody wanted to go out to dinner with me. Because it's just like, it's just a real pain in the ass being next to a famous person in a restaurant or in a club or something like that. And I think that helped us to drift apart. And add on just the exhaustion of having 3 albums in a row, a lot of success, 7 years of non-stop touring. At one point, we were only in the country 2 months of the whole year.
Whoa.
Because that was the way in those days. You just had to tour. There was no social media. You just had to tour your ass off. And we did 8 tours of America. We did countless tours of Europe and Eastern Europe and, you know, Russia and all these other places, Japan, Australia. And we were just tired. And I was tired of just being by myself all the time and just not feeling supported and all of those things. But, you know, at the end of the day, that was kind of it. There was no big bust up. We just drifted apart. And then I was like, you know, I just want to make different music for a minute. I just want to do something else.
Faithfulness distracts me from my ever-changing tastefulness. My mouth upon the richest tongues I roam. For this static at the same time by it all. Common sense can slap me in the face, and yet I condescend, embarrassed by your obvious indifference, disgusted. My ego breaks your fall.
You did Flesh Wounds, didn't you?
Yeah, I did Flesh Wounds and Fake Chemical State. You know, that both, I think Flesh Wounds did 1 million. Fake Chemical State did about 500,000. I think that's when the internet started.
That'll do. That's not bad.
They did really well, but I didn't enjoy it. I didn't like being a solo artist. You need a healthy dose of narcissism. You need a healthy dose of me, me, me to be a truly great solo star. And I don't mean that as a disrespect. I mean, that's just what you need to be able to do the job. And I was always trying to get a band. I always had band mentality. And I realized after a while that it was all a bit fake because my word was my word and I was the top of the tree and everyone was just trying to work out what I wanted instead of being themselves and having their own opinions. And in Skunk and Nancy, I never had that. It was always like everybody else mattered a lot in terms of the decisions, in terms of what we want to look like, in terms of writing the songs. Eventually, we just kind of came back into like, let's just be a band again. And we'd all missed it. I think we'd all take the band for granted and realize that, you know, we had to go back into the desert and go and find the diamond that was in the band and dust it off and put it in its, you know, in the middle of the crown again.
People take bands for granted. They just, you know, assume your band's going to be around. And it's easy to forget how connected you were to an artist until they go away and they come back. And if the band does it right, and not everyone does it right, if it does it right, it can really reignite the love you had for an artist, and it can introduce them generationally to another audience, and you find yourself kind of in a celebratory state. You're almost paying tribute to the work you've done as well as doing new stuff, which is a lovely place to be in.
I mean, I think that what brought us back together again was Facebook, really, and Instagram and all these. There was a petition on Facebook to get Skunk and Nancy to get back together again. And it got like, I don't know, 200,000 signatures or something like that. And so we thought, well, that's a good place to start. Also a scary place to start, because I think there's a lot of nostalgia in that.
Yeah.
And I think that that's interesting and fun. But my thing was, well, if we can't write good songs, we'll just do a tour and then end it. Because I'm not going to be in a band that's just going to play old songs forever. I think there's nothing wrong with that. I just didn't want to be in that band. You know, I was DJing techno at that point. I was listening to a lot of really interesting records. And I didn't want to just be like the lead singer, Skunk and Nancy, that was big in the 90s. I think if that's how everybody wanted to do it, I didn't want to do it. And I think everybody was on the same thing. It's like, no, we love making new music. We love being creative. And it has to have a healthy dosage of that. Or it's just not the same thing. We got back together because of the petition, kind of inspired us, and we felt very honored about that and quite grateful for that. But then we were like, well, let's just use this as a launch pad to do other things. And then, you know, some of those records were great and some of them weren't so good. I loved Wanderluster. Didn't really like the other one that came after that, Black Traffic. That was kind of an annoying record. But then, you know, I think all of those things put us in a position of making Painful Truth, which I think is an amazing record.
I think Shame is one of the best things you've ever written.
I saw you standing trying to shelter. Cold fingers tracing icy skin. Your story sounds so familiar. You said too much to take it in. I got the love from my mother. I got the pain from my dad. I got the blood
So, what's next? What else is the rest of the year looking like for you guys?
We're just about to do two shows with Smashing Pumpkins, and it's really about planning next year. We want to do some special stuff next year. We're also starting to write a new record because it took a long time. And so we want to make sure we're kind of back in there with a new record quite quickly after The Painful Truth, because the way that we're making records is not a short, sharp process. It's much more intricate to be able to get to those feelings, to get to those melodies and to write those songs. Not always fun process either.
And the final question we ask everybody, what shall we play to end the show? It can be something of yours, something of someone else's, something you've loved for your whole life, something you've just heard this morning. What should we go out on?
I'm going to go for one of ours. I'm going to go for An Artist Is An Artist. That was the song we wrote for this new album that changed everything. That was the song that became the benchmark for the rest of the album. And New Skunk and Nancy in many ways. You know, it's something that needed to be said and wanted to be said. And yes, it's a bit cheeky chaffy and it's a bit silly and a bit naughty. But I think in this day and age, I think one of the things that musicians have to be really prepared for is that they have to remember who the artist is and not be led by their followers, but be led by their own souls and their own creativity.
And that's the song we should finish on. It's been good to speak to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Zimmer frame and leaf, put down her pen, put on a hat because I've met a boss. An artist is an artist, her heart and all his arteries clog up and wipe ourselves, they unsuspend themselves. Cause an artist is an artist, too deaf to watch the parties, to the brain is a sensation of his function.
That was An Artist Is An Artist by Skunk Anansie, the final choice of my guest here on The First Time Today, Skin. As I said, artists can choose their own songs to end the programme, and why not? And thank you to Skin for being my guest. That's the end of this show. I'll be back tomorrow with another brand new episode of The First Time for this season, where my guest will be Creedence Clearwater Revival legend John Fogerty. And of course, you can listen back to previous First Time shows from this season on BBC Sound, which include my episodes with Jim Moyer, also known as Vic Reeves, and Ezra Furman. Until next time, I've been Matt Everett. Thanks for listening.